You're listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast. For I Will Be With You. Daily reflections on recovery from the Bible.
Welcome back to the For I Will Be With You podcast. My name is Baruch. I'm an alcoholic, and I'll be your host. And just a quick reminder, if you like this podcast, please consider reviewing it and sharing it on social media. We'd really appreciate it. So this is the podcast for the 19th week of the year, from May 6th to May 12th, covering from Exodus 24:11 through Exodus 27:1. So at this moment in the story of Exodus, we are at the moment of the revealing of the Ten Commandments. And in Exodus 24:11, we have a description of what happens right after the giving of the Ten Commandments. And it says, "Against the great men of the children of Israel, he did not stretch out his hand," meaning God, "his hand. They gazed at God, yet they ate and drank." So this is a description of a moment when the sort of great people, the great men, the leaders of the Israelite nation were at Mount Sinai, and they had some unique prophetic vision, only they, because they were at a high level spiritually, and yet they decided for some reason at that time to eat and drink. And in the context of this, this was considered inappropriate and sort of an insult to God, I guess you could say. This is something that is not a very well understood moment, at least for me, in the Bible. But what is important is you can just look at it sort of in the basic facts and see what might be helpful to understand from a recovery perspective. That here you have people who are at a high level spiritually, and they participated in probably the greatest spiritual experience in the history of humanity, the revelation of the divine law, God personally giving the law to humanity, a unique event, a singularly important event, and they decided it was a good time to grab a bite to eat. So something isn't right with what's going on, and God was angry with them. And this is sort of maybe like some of our behavior in addiction. We have an opportunity in recovery to create a personal connection with God. And a lot of us are able to get that connection going, but sometimes we react to it by just continuing with our bad behavior, eating and drinking sort of in the face of God and ignoring God, really, I think, from a position of ego, saying like, "Hey, I'm hungry, I gotta eat. Doesn't matter that I gotta use and act out because I want to, I need it. Doesn't matter that I'm in the presence of God, so because I'm important and more important than God." And I think that if we can quiet down our egos, we might be able to open ourselves up more to God and get into a better recovery. But the other aspect of this moment in the Bible is that God is very forgiving. It says he did not stretch out his hand. He did not punish these men for this behavior. So God, you can learn from this that God withholds his anger, and he gives us many chances to return to his presence. Now, in Exodus 25:1, we begin a very long intermittent series of instructions to the Israelites about the building of the tabernacle in the wilderness. Okay, so there's many, many verses of the Bible from now on deal with the tabernacle, and we're going to talk about it at pretty big length. For it has a lot of spiritual messages for us in recovery. But in Exodus 25:1, God spoke to Moses saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and let them take for me a portion From every man whose heart motivates him, you shall take my portion. Now, what God is talking about here is what is commonly known as a tithe, or a gift to in this case, a gift of money or other materials to the religious authority here. This takes many forms, but the idea is that God wants each person to donate for the construction of the Holy Tabernacle, which is also called the Mishkan. Sometimes you'll hear me talk about the Mishkan. If you read Jewish texts, you sometimes read about the Mishkan. They're talking about the Tabernacle. The Tabernacle that was built in the wilderness was a precursor to the temple that was built in Jerusalem. It was a very similar design, just smaller. Each Israelite is commanded to separate a portion of his resources and donate. So the idea is that the Israelites would give of themselves to create a holy space for worship. And this is about more than just fundraising and bookkeeping. It's about giving back a portion of what God has given you to nurture your soul. And in AA, we say the group is self-supporting through its own contributions. This is the same idea. AA exists because people contribute their resources towards its upkeep. This is not really a bookkeeping exercise, although you don't want to ignore the fact that money is obviously necessary, but it's about taking personal responsibility and following through on a spiritual commitment. And what God, as well as the founders of AA, understood was that spiritual commitment only works if people independently support their spiritual work. If someone else is paying for it, or no one is paying for it, the work can suffer. Exodus 25:8, we get the specific instruction. It says, "They shall make a sanctuary for me so that I may dwell among them." God is saying that they should build the tabernacle in the wilderness. And there are some now very interesting illustrations that have been done actually by professional architects advised by biblical scholars on what this tabernacle actually looked like. And it's an interesting thing to look up online. There's a lot of fascinating detail in it. But the tabernacle had the altar, the holy altar, where the priests, the Levites, and the Kohanim, the priests of the Israelite nation, would offer sacrifices to God, animal sacrifices. And they would also burn incense and they'd sacrifice things like flour and oil and stuff on the altar. Now, at a basic level, the tabernacle was considered the location of God's presence among the Israelites. Now, this should immediately cause a question, which is that God is everywhere. God cannot be contained in a building. It seems almost laughably like, okay, we're going to build a building, and God's going to be there. That seems ridiculous and a height of arrogance. But it's also important God has wisdom to understand that human beings need a place to worship. It helps in the making the connection with the higher power. And God commanded the people to construct a holy space. Now, some people are spiritually gifted and they can sort of feel God's presence all the time. But most of us need a structure, a number of different structures to make this process work. We usually need a physical space. We usually need a text of some kind to work off of. In meetings, like, you know, you can sit in a room by yourself and work your program, and you can communicate with your higher power and so forth. And that's great, but you need to go to the meeting too, because the meeting room, wherever it is, it can be a holy space. And I certainly have experienced this. And it's almost in direct contrast to the space itself. Like, I have been in the grubbiest little rooms in rehab centers and church basements and all kinds of little out-of-the-way places that you wouldn't consider holy, if you looked at it. They weren't like, you know, marble and gold and stained glass. They were just like little rooms with plastic chairs and bad coffee. But that's where the really important work was taking place. God was in those rooms. And I can tell you, and I think a lot of us have been through this, that sometimes the best conscious contact with our higher power comes in these very unlikely places, almost because of their unlikeliness. Now, we start to get into really specific instructions. And quite a lot of the book of Exodus and book of Leviticus are devoted to a lot of really fine-grained detail about how to build this tabernacle. And it's a little bit perplexing sometimes to people who aren't familiar with the Bible. They're like, really? We got to go through all this detail? The answer is yes, because we're going to find important spiritual concepts in a lot of these details. So in Exodus 25:10, it says, they, meaning the Israelites, they shall make an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits its length, 1.5 cubits its width, and 1.5 cubits its height. So the question that a lot of people ask, as a famous comedian once asked, is, what is a cubit? So a cubit, nobody really knows what a cubit was, but it's for the sake of argument, it's approximately 18 inches. It's the length of a man's forearm up to the tips of his fingers, which is about 24 inches, up to 24 inches. So you can imagine this ark is about, 5 feet wide and 3 feet high, whatever. It's you can sort of imagine the shape of it. So this is the first of many detailed instructions that God gives to the Israelites on how to construct a tabernacle. And we have a lot of details like this coming. So from the modern perspective, in the modern mind, you might think this detail doesn't really make sense. Like, why should the ark be exactly 2.5 cubits in length? Couldn't God have just said, make an ark out of wood? And why this particular kind of wood, acacia wood? The answer is, God could have given us general instructions. Yeah, make an ark, okay? But he doesn't. God gives us specific instructions. Now, we can take a guess at why God wants these specific dimensions, and there are many, many commentaries and discussions about the meaning of these numbers and the sizes and so forth. I'm not going to get into them. One of the things you can take out of this is you will never know the real reason. This is something, it's almost a challenge to our modern egos. Like, you cannot really know for sure what God wants. And anybody who says, I know exactly what God wants, is probably exaggerating or not being completely straight with you. And Recovery 2 has its kind of comparable instructions. Certainly in the beginning, you get into recovery, you're given direction. Doesn't make a lot of sense when you first hear them, especially if you've been in your headspace of drinking and using. You're not really up for taking direction, and you've been sort of directing your own life, often with disastrous consequences. So you hear an instruction like, so your sponsor says, call me every day. And you're like, really? Why do I have to call you every day? Well, you should just take the direction, because there's a reason your sponsor is telling you that. Call me every day. Pray every day. These are directions that may not make sense, but after you've been sober for a while, you're going to see that they may have saved your life and that God had a reason to put that sponsor in your path and give you these directions. So this continues. Exodus 25:31 says, you shall make a menorah of pure gold. Hammered out shall the menorah be made. Now the menorah is a 7-branched candelabra, and I would imagine almost all of us have seen images of this. It's very common thing to see during the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah. You see in people's windows. It's a symbol of the state of Israel and so forth. It's a very famous symbol of Judaism, the menorah, 7-branched candelabra. What a lot of people don't understand is, because the menorahs we have today are small, like, you know, you put them in your window or whatever. This menorah was very large. It was probably as tall as a man. And it was a key part of the tabernacle. And what's important is he's saying, out of pure gold it shall be hammered. Now, a very tiny digression into gold here. As you may know, gold is a soft metal, and it can be hammered into different shapes. Like a goldsmith can take a solid piece of gold and, like, hammer it and turn it into a cup or a ring or whatever, like, without melting it or casting it or whatever. welding it together. But so what God is saying is, take a single piece of gold, it's a pretty large piece of gold, maybe like a square foot of gold, and hammer it until it becomes a candelabra with extremely elaborate decoration, little, leaves and curls and, wrinkles and stuff in the gold, and hammer it into a 7-branched candelabra as tall as a human being. And what goldsmiths have said is that this is really impossible. The greatest goldsmith in the world could not do this. And he is, God is instructing Moses to do this. Moses is an 82-year-old man who has no goldsmithing experience. So how is this really possible? Why is God asking the Israelites to do the impossible? So there's got to be a reason, right? God's asking for a reason. He doesn't say, God doesn't say, go to a factory that makes menorahs and buy one. He's not saying, you know, do whatever you have to do with the metal work to make this work. He's saying it has to come from a single piece of gold. And so one interpretation of this is that this is a symbolic instruction that for the Israelites, or really for any human society, that we are all the same at the core. We all come from the same piece of gold, so to speak. We are all God's children, but we will express ourselves in different ways. We will branch out. There will be different branches of the human family, and we will light up the world, so to speak, like these candles, these lamps, in our own ways, in different branches. And so there's obviously also a lot of commentary on what these seven branches are, and we're not going to get into that, but the concept is that it's like they say on the dollar bill, e pluribus unum, from many, one. So similarly, another way to look at it in recovery is that we each have our own different ways of expressing recovery and expressing our relationships with our higher powers, but we're all coming from the same place, really, which is we want the conscious contact with God. We want to be sober. We may express it in different ways. We may present ourselves in different ways. Another aspect of this is that, like the menorah that was formed out of a piece of gold, we too are sort of shapeless. Like, we might as well be, when you come into recovery, maybe you could relate to this, you are sort of like a shapeless lump of metal. You're basically nothing. You're, if anything, misshapen. So, but maybe with recovery, you can sort of hammer yourself back into being a functioning human being, and you could become something beautiful, something that spreads light in the world. Now, in Exodus 25:31, repeat again. It says, "Making a menorah of pure gold, hammered out, shall the menorah be made." So this is a seemingly impossible task. There's no goldsmith in the world who could do this, certainly not Moses. So what the commentary says, so how did this work? Well, what the commentary says, and this is a guess, but it's a guess based on scholarship and knowledge of the Torah, is that God showed Moses an image of what the menorah should look like in some vision, and Moses took a large piece of gold and threw it into a fire. And from the fire emerged this perfectly formed menorah. So it's basically a miracle. And this is an idea that should resonate in recovery, which is that, you know, as I was saying a minute ago, we're also kind of like these shapeless lumps of metal or lumps of gold. If we're willing to be thrown into the fire of recovery, and trusting God, we too can be shaped into something beautiful and spiritual. It takes trust, takes courage. And you know, and there's going to be moments in recovery when we simply won't believe the value of the advice we're being given. Like a direction doesn't really make any sense, but it's helpful if you can react to it. It's like, okay, just throw the gold in the fire. Trust in God, something beautiful will come out. And this is the kind of thing we see in recovery. It's like, okay, I'm just going to trust the process. I'm going to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I'm like a piece of gold. I'm going to throw myself in the fire, and God will shape me miraculously into something beautiful in the process. Of course, I have to show up for those meetings. You can't just stay home and expect it to happen. But there's an idea that's communicated in the symbolism of the menorah, that this is something that can happen if you trust in God. Exodus 27:1 says, "You shall make an altar of acacia wood, 5 cubits in length and 5 cubits in width. The altar shall be square." So they were continuing with these detailed instructions of the tabernacle. We're given precise measurement and materials for the altar. The altar was a place where animal sacrifices were offered on a fire to God. Now again, this is going to come up a fair amount here. There are certain things that are going on that may seem hard to understand from modern perspective. The idea of, you know, sacrificing an animal seems kind of maybe barbaric, or, you know, like certainly not relevant to the modern world. But again, I think we should look at it as an opportunity to grow spiritually from understanding the symbolism and the divine message in the instruction, even if we don't completely understand the ritual. You know, God has instructions for us that contain details that don't seem relevant. So we say, okay, but let's try for a second. Let's try it out. Okay, we're going to go with the animal sacrifice thing. Do we really need to make the altar 3 cubits high? What if it's 4 cubits high? Will God care? And the answer is yes. The Torah does not waste words or describe spurious ideas. This is an important concept in biblical scholarship. There's no extraneous language in the Bible. If there's a phrase, it means something. If you don't know what it means, the defect is with us, not with the text. Now, this may be a little controversial for some people, but this is an important idea just to grasp. The message here is one of humility. Meaning, for example, if you're reading the Big Book and you read something that doesn't make sense to you, it's probably a problem with you, not the book. If God is telling you something in the Bible and you don't understand it, like, why does this altar have to be this exact size? Think about the fact that you don't understand it, and why? Because that means something about the way your mind is working. And maybe you'll never understand it, and that is also an important lesson to learn. Sometimes you don't know. But letting go of the ego and saying, okay, it's all right, it's okay not to know something, I will figure it out later if I can, and if I can't figure it out, I'm going to learn about myself by getting in touch with the fact that I don't understand it. That's what humility is all about, and humility is one of the most important aspects of growing in recovery.
You've been listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast, daily reflections on recovery from the Bible. www.foriwillbewithyou.com